Hello and welcome back again to Red Star Radio. This time we're coming to you with an episode that is hot off the presses of the Internet Tape Machine. This week we're looking at the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, particularly inspired by an article on Zero Hedge where they dug out the agreement that the current president of Ukraine, Zelensky, had signed, inspired or forced into by the Biden White House, where they declared that it was Ukrainian policy to formally retake control over the Russian-occupied parts of what had formerly been Ukraine, namely Crimea, Sevastopol, Mariupol, etc. So we're going to be looking at, first of all, what's going on there, why that is. But Leila, do you want to say a little bit about the broader things we'll be looking at and why that's important?
So this renewal of conflict in the Ukraine is an excellent way of understanding the current dynamics in imperialism in our world today, and also like understanding how that links up with the fall of the USSR, which is really important to understanding the dynamics of today's imperialism. It links up to a lot of things that are going on most directly at Russia, but also with China. And so understanding it's within the within the context of the Ukraine conflict is a really good place to start. And then finally, the restarting of aggression in that region has caused some consternation, and people are talking about broader war and kind of making these quite hysterical conclusions about what's going on. But also the other kind of side of it is just silence on the issue as well. So I think it's good for us to come in with a balanced perspective and help people understand what's really going on.
Yes, this is a podcast where we look to dispel hysteria
and apathy.
And apathy at the same time. And as Leila was saying, the mixture of responses to the current escalation in eastern Ukraine have ranged from just completely ignoring it, which is what a lot of the bourgeois press have done, only to say that the Russians are increasing hostile activity. And then you get a lot of the hysterical stuff from the bourgeois press in the United States about, you know, Emperor Putin planning to roll his tanks all the way up to the English Channel. Of course, none of this is what's really going on. And what's actually going on is the long-running conflict that has been going on inside eastern Ukraine for now 7 years, since 2014. So what's happening now is you have obviously in 2014, the Russians citing their wish to defend the Russian majority in Crimea, took over that particular part of Ukraine. Mainly, though, it was to defend their strategically important naval base. And now you also have the semi-breakaway independent Republic of Donbass, which is a majority Russian-speaking area, which has various different demands around that have been made. But the principal one at the moment is that this is it's seen as a pro-Russian rebellion. And now the Ukrainian government, following failure to retake these areas the first time they lost them, are now transporting large amounts of men and war material over to the east. The Russians are responding in kind. And so you get the article in Zero Hedge where, as is always the case with a lot of Zero Hedge articles, they start hyperventilating about World War III. It's my personal analysis that that's very, very unlikely. And this is just another round of sort of shifting for position between the different players involved. But that's sort of the overview of the current state of things. We're going to come back to how things currently look later on. But we'll turn now to where did this conflict emerge from? So, Leila, do you want to just say a little bit about where the modern iteration of Ukraine emerges from?
So the Ukraine was never an independent nation ever, except shortly during the Russian Revolution, but then it was integrated within the USSR and had since then been a part of that. When the USSR fell in 1990, it became an independent nation for the first time. And it immediately, after the USSR fell, created a local class of like oligarchs, which still to this day control the country. They emerged out of the privatization of industry that the USSR had built up, especially heavy industry. And so you hear a lot about corruption and things like that coming out of the Ukraine. And the reason is because there is a lot of corruption in the Ukraine, but it's through this informal network of oligarchs that maintain a comparative advantage over transnational capital. And that's why the West is always trying to attack it, because they want to create kind of an equal playing field, so to speak, so that transnational capital can come in and take advantage of the as of yet not fully privatized areas in the Ukraine, but also to compete on a level playing field with the oligarchs that currently exist. Since the country was kind of privatized and taken over by oligarchs since 1990, it hasn't really been able to create this solid state. Like, there is no one segment of capital that there hasn't been a capitalist bloc that has been able to maintain hegemony, unlike Russia, which has a political elite that dominate all the oligarchs, but serve their interests kind of collectively. Ukraine has more political pluralism because there's always these shifting fields of power that is very competitive political terrain. And since the USSR fell, including that, there's been three revolutions. So over the lifetime of one Ukrainian who was born in the early 1990s, they would have seen three revolutions already, like one in 1990, one in 2004, and one in 2014. I think that the interesting thing about the Ukraine is that while the privatization of industry has happened, it hasn't been fully liberalized. Like, it's been liberalized very unevenly. And there's still a lot of Soviet era legislation that has been maintained around things like housing and labor issues. The prices of utilities is still quite heavily subsidized, which has been the target of regular criticism by the international community and the IMF. But because there's been a lack of investment from the ruling oligarchs, it still has resulted in the degradation of Ukraine's public sector and state apparatus, including its army. And so the nation is very fractured. It hasn't been able to kind of reunite all of the different identity groups and ethnic groups that exist within it. And in contrast, it's actually exacerbated the differences between them, which is kind of a top-down result of the fact that there is no one hegemonic faction within the Ukraine. I think that the reason why the factions are maintained and have so much life in them is because there's some oligarchs that are focused on heavy industry and natural resources, and there's others who are more into light industry and media and culture. And it's very difficult. Foreign direct investment doesn't happen as much for heavy industry because it requires a lot of upfront investment, which isn't as attractive as other industries, which would require less investment. So I think that the factions are maintained via that split. There's some that are more NATO and Western friendly because they are more receptive and more able to receive a lot of direct foreign investment. And there's the other faction that's more Russia friendly because they are more heavy industry. And so they just want to maintain their privileges. And they're not really seeing a huge advantage in opening up the country to foreign direct investment as much. The material kind of basis for the splits are there. I mean, it's created quite a kind of chaotic situation for the Ukraine. You have this exaggeration of national and intra-national differences. And also you have the fact that the army has also been so weak. And so oligarchs have been able to maintain private militias in various areas of the country, which creates a very violent and turbulent situation. And then you have Russia come in and fund its own independent militias as well.
Yeah, and it's worth emphasizing as well that when the Ukrainian population were actually consulted about what they wanted in Gorbachev's ill-fated referendum in March 1991, the population of Ukraine as it was then, which is actually higher than it is now, it was 52 million back in 1991. It's only 44 million now because the population has shrunk as the economy has stagnated and slowly collapsed. So out of a registered voting base of 37 million, 22 million voted to remain within a continuing USSR. And that was 71% of the turnout voted to stay in. And then that's reflected again and again in like opinion poll surveys of like the working class of Ukraine, both West and East, stating that they clearly had a better, more secure existence under the prior government of the Soviet Union, even in the days when, thanks to Gorbachev screwing a lot of things up, that was something that was on the slide economically. So as is the case in a lot of places where capitalist restoration has gone appallingly badly, like a lot of the Balkan countries also, for instance, the previous socialist governments, or actually existing socialism as it used to be referred to, is a great deal more popular than the currently actually existing capitalist regimes that are there. And as Leila was saying, the failure of the Ukrainian bourgeoisie to do anything other than basically loot the place has led to a tremendous dissatisfaction and also a tremendous political apathy. And this also manifests itself when you get up to the 2014 events, where you have various different oligarchs a lot of them backed Yanukovych, who was called the Russian-aligned Yanukovych. But that's not strictly true, because as is the case in a lot of with a lot of Ukrainian politics, there was a continual shift in his outlook from being somebody who was aligned more with Moscow to being somebody who was basically going to be aligned with Germany and the wider EU, and then back again to Moscow. It's like there is not a lot of like, these aren't people with a fixed set of beliefs. They go wherever their wallets go. And Poroshenko, the next president, was after the Maidan, was exactly the same. He'd been both in favor of and against every administration since 1991. So it's the guy who liked to play the odds. You have Ukraine, even when it went through periods of growth, the country is still losing a lot of its industry because the oligarchy wasn't interested in reinvesting. You see a lot of population outflow to Germany and Poland and Russia. Remittances sent from overseas became a big part of the national income. And that's always a sign of a country that's not going forward, it's going backwards. Back even under the later period of the Soviet Union, this was a country that was tremendously agriculturally developed. It was one of the main agricultural areas of the old USSR. It was one of the main areas for extraction industries, but also light industry and manufacturing. And a lot of that just got asset stripped and destroyed. And a lot of the capital that had been raided from that by the oligarchs flowed out of the country. So these aren't people with a great degree of interest in reinvesting inside Ukraine itself. They have a lot of interest in taking money outside of it. And this is, as you were saying, this is why the state apparatus is so decayed. It's why the Ukrainian army was so useless and incapable, because the state, the oligarchs only really had an interest in just using the state to bolster their own bank balances. Not actually even, they hadn't even gotten to the point that the Russian capitalist class did in the late 90s, where they backed a Putin figure to reestablish the authority of the state over the nation and preserve the territorial integrity of the country and also establish a basic functioning state machine. That's not even been reached yet. Because the Ukrainian bourgeoisie is so weak, it just literally goes between whatever imperialist players are on the scene and keeps bouncing between them. The latest move since 2014 has seen them more in bed with Washington and to a certain extent Berlin as well. But there's no reason to believe that this won't swing back again at some stage, although the events in the East make that a little less likely. So the state apparatus is very weak. You have a divided and parasitic oligarchy class. And now this oligarchy class was unable to transition properly into a capitalist economy and was unable to solve any of these problems. This is actually what's led up to the crisis that did occur in 2014. Did you want to say anything more before we move into a discussion of that?
Yeah, like, so just to build up to 2014, so Ukraine was going through a lot of kind of political turmoil prior to 2008, when the global economic crisis hit. Imperialist intervention wasn't as big of a factor in the Ukraine, but I think that the real big breaking point for the West was when the IMF loaned the Ukraine money. The IMF loaned money to the Ukraine, and as a condition of this loan, wanted to force the state, who was run at that point by Yanukovych, to stop subsidizing state-run energy companies. The state-run energy company, which provides energy at one-fourth of the cost of importing the gas. The gas, of course, comes from Russia. And at that point, that was a real breaking point, like whether the Ukraine was going to go and stick with Russia or join the Western capitalist bloc. Yanukovych did not touch the subsidies. The IMF put the loan on ice, and instead Yanukovych ended up signing taking a loan from Russia for to the tune of $15 billion, if I'm not mistaken. That's when like the real contestation goes on, so like it starts to go on between like the West and Russia in terms of the Ukraine. But yeah, like I think that like a lot of this stuff is covered up by like things about how Russia is trying to reestablish some kind of ethnic nationalism, and that's why he invaded Ukraine. That's not why that is. Like it was because Yanukovych guy decided to ally himself with Russia at that point and turned his back on the Western capitalist bloc, as far as I kind of understand it.
Yeah, there's the other piece of this puzzle here is that the role of the US and the other Western nations inside Ukraine, and also the role of the US inside a lot of the former Soviet bloc countries. And to understand this, you have to look at like the history of the development of capitalism in Russia post 91, or really post 93, after Yeltsin's coup against his own parliament. So the bringing in of Putin as a sort of as the figure who was going to stabilize things and be, in the words of one Western observer back in the late 90s, be a sober Yeltsin. This was a double-edged sword for the West, because they didn't want Russia to be just a complete basket case, because they didn't want it to be just its incredibly unstable presence. I mean, but at the same time, they didn't want it to develop in a way that could lead to a challenge. So they wanted somebody who would be just a bit more stable than Yeltsin, but still keep Russia so weak that it couldn't actually push back against any Western maneuvers that were going on in and around the old Soviet bloc and the old Soviet sphere of influence. But what happens is that Putin, who is really just in essence, a Russian liberal, I mean, there's nothing more to him than that. There's so much time and space dedicated in the capitalist media to psychoanalyzing the guy. But he comes from out of obviously the old KGB turned FSB. He was director of the FSB. And he's very much linked to the sort of the capitalist class in Russia that arises out of the St. Petersburg political machine in the early 90s. So he's very much part of the counter-revolution against the Soviet Union. So this idea that he was somehow some sort of, what, long-term Soviet sleeper agent who was going to pull the mask off and it's Stalin underneath is just something which, like, very, very silly American bourgeois liberals have created as a fantasy for themselves. So what he is a Russian liberal who came in as a representative of the dominant factions in the new Russian capitalist class and sought to arrest the disintegration of the country that had taken place under Yeltsin, because even though the Russian oligarchs needed a degree of chaos in order to essentially seize control over huge swaths of formerly state-owned industry, once they'd got that, they didn't want the chaos anymore. They wanted things to calm down. They wanted the state to be able to do all the things that a typical capitalist state can do, sort of ensuring the safety of private property, ensuring that there's some sort of legal framework in place, ensuring that there is stability for both internal and external investment in the country. And he does all that, Putin. So, but the thing that the West doesn't, either doesn't count on or doesn't see coming because they're distracted from their, the US and Britain are distracted because of their imperialist campaigns in the Middle East. Of course, Russia is too big a country with too big a selection of natural resources to remain a backwater because it's simply got to, there's too much of it, there's too many resources there for it to just remain a small cog in the global economy that would easily be dismissed or dominated. So by the time 2004 rolls around, the capitalist class in Russia has stabilized. The state has now reasserted itself over the territorial length and breadth of Russia. There's no more open, like, private armies as there was in the 90s, run by different oligarchs. The most egregious forms of, like, oligarchical sort of excesses has been somewhat curbed. So, like, Viktor Khodorkovsky, the notorious energy mogul who had ambitions to be president, he was tossed in jail. Like, a lot of the others fled to London because, you know, what better place to come if you're a corrupt bastard with loads of money? Come on in. So the time when you get the first attempt at a color revolution in Ukraine in 2004 is when you've got the Russian capitalist class starting to assert itself more outside of the country, particularly in its periphery, because it has now stabilized and it's starting to make some serious profits off of the selling of natural resources to the global market. So this is when suddenly you start to see in the press, in Britain and the United States in particular, a lot of the scare stories, of the line on Putin changes overnight from being our guy Vlad to being this sinister figure. And it's because suddenly they've worked out that, oh, right, the Russian capitalist class won't just stay in a box. They're going to do what all large capitalist classes do with a huge natural resource pile that they're sitting on. They're going to start investing elsewhere and they're going to start asserting themselves to protect their investments. And the fact that they were... So 2004, where you got the so-called Orange Revolution, where you had Yushchenko, who was labeled as the pro-West candidate, and then Yanukovych, who was labeled as the pro-Kremlin candidate. And it was some kinds of shit went on, and like Yushchenko got poisoned or something, and like came out of hiding with like a hideously scarred face. And there was a whole load of controversy over, there was allegations that the former president, Leonid Kuchma, had like somehow rigged the election. And there was suddenly a tent city opened up in the middle of Kiev. And this is starting to sound familiar because this is the playbook for a lot of these color revolutions that the Americans run via their sort of NGO arm's length agencies and that the British MI6 does as well. And there was, so then the outcome of this attempt at a color revolution is some sort of hash up deal where various allies of Yushchenko go into the government. Yushchenko does end up as president at one stage later on, but this is all, this tension between the Americans and the Russians starts to express itself there. Because you see the Russians actually getting their act together as a capitalist class and starting to wanting to control more over their immediate, what you call the sort of Russian near abroad.
Then you date that as 2004 then, is that right?
I'd say it's the early 2000s. It's after 2001.
Mm. Okay.
So because it's after that, because I don't know if you remember, like George Bush said that like he'd looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and seen his soul. And it was good. That after that, like, and when Russia opposes the Iraq war, even though it was the French leading that effort, and then when the Americans are sort of bogged down in Iraq and, to all intents and purposes, losing against the Iraqis who are resisting them, then they start to get very suspicious of Putin and his intentions.
Okay, so then 2004 or early 2000s, Russians start asserting themselves. And then Yanukovych comes into power around that time. And then there's a color revolution as a response because, and you're kind of arguing that it was as a response of the fact that Yanukovych is pro-Russia. And obviously the West was probably involved in maybe pushing this Orange Revolution forward.
Yeah, definitely. There's a chopping and changing between Yanukovych and others. So Yanukovych was prime minister for a while. And then, after the Orange Revolution, he doesn't actually end up as president. But he does, in the end, become prime minister again. And Yushchenko is president for a while, but Yushchenko doesn't solve anything, basically, which seems to be a theme here. And then
is Yushchenko a pro-West guy?
Yeah, Yushchenko and Yanukovych were running against each other in the 2004 presidential election. And Yushchenko, the allegation was that either the current president or the old president, Leonid Kuchma, or somehow Putin or somebody poisons Yushchenko to try and knock him out of the race, because he's running as this sort of pro-Western reformer type character, even though he's just another puppet of a different set of oligarchs, basically.
Okay, so then Yushchenko's put in power, but then he loses power. Yanukovych is back in power.
Yanukovych comes back in 2010.
Right.
So he then wins a new term in office, a term in office as president from 2010, and serves to 2014.
So then at that point, the Ukraine is still reeling from the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah.
And then the EU and both Russia and the EU approach the Ukraine with offers of support.
Mm-hmm.
So the EU has offers around $800 million worth of loans, whereas with a lot more conditions than Russia has. And Russia, conversely, offers a $15 billion loan with far less conditions. And so then at that point, Yanukovych signs with Russia, mm-hmm. Accepts Russia's offer. And this really sets off the Maidan, correct?
Yeah. Because they'd not solved anything from 2008, and really, even when they'd undergone a period of economic growth in the early to mid 2000s, it didn't make up for the collapse that had occurred in the 90s. So
yes.
Ukraine, mm-hmm. since 91 had just been getting poorer and poorer in reality. And none of the oligarchs managed to solve any of this, because none of them really had much interest in doing so. It was just different factions squabbling for power. Now, so the triggering for it was the Yanukovych balks at the conditions being imposed by the EU IMF. And unsurprisingly, because it threatened to upset the balance of power in Ukraine. And Yanukovych is obviously, you know, a corrupt bastard, just a guy of the oligarchy, just as much as anybody else is. But I think with some of them, as you were saying, because they have certain interests more related to heavy industry, and because Yanukovych had been in a coalition with the Communist Party of Ukraine for a little while, they'd been a part of his coalition. And as part of that, like, he, of course, did make certain guarantees that he was going to preserve certain things from the Soviet period. So the health system being one, like the state control over certain energy resources being another. And of course, that's what was unacceptable to the EU IMF, which wanted all of that up for privatization as soon as possible, essentially. And of course, added onto that, then you get their usual demands, which they make to everybody who they try and impose, like, a loan system and structural adjustment program on, which are, well, we want you to cut public sector wages and we want you to cut pensions as well.
Mm, yes.
And Yanukovych balks at that because I think he was probably worried about the instability that would follow. Not that he would, this isn't out of altruism or any great feeling for the working class of Ukraine. I think he was probably thinking, well, the coalition I put together is probably going to fall apart and I'm for it if I sign this. But I think he seems to have underestimated the fact that there was a certain section of the oligarchy in the west of the country had been more and more coming into the orbit of the United States for quite a long time. Certainly, the US's NGO intelligence arms like USAID and various other different sort of think tanks and NGOs had been flooding Ukraine, what passes for Ukrainian civil society, which isn't a lot, with money and resources. And they've been developing people through their their training programs all the way up to 2014. So by the time you reach there, you do have a network in place which is funded by Washington, London, and to a certain extent probably Berlin as well, who are trained in the art of carrying off this sort of color revolution type event. And then added to that, you have this very hard right neo-fascist element, which a lot of whom are tied to being like the personal militias of various different oligarchs, who draw on a historical legacy of fascism in the Ukraine going back to like the 1940s, and when a certain section of the Ukrainian petty bourgeoisie had sided with the Nazis. And that historical lineage was very much on display in the Maidan itself, where like the far right were in an open alliance with the liberal wing of the sort of the Western Ukrainian bourgeoisie, and it was the far right who were providing the forces on the street that were out there doing all the battles in the dramatic footage that everybody saw at the time. And there's, of course, a whole load of other stories about like what was actually going on during those street battles. There were stories that Yanukovych had ordered snipers onto the roof of buildings to take people out. Then it was revealed that that wasn't actually him, that that might have been people working for the far right, deliberately shooting both demonstrators and cops to try and amp things up further. But essentially, it gets to a point where all of the oligarchy abandons Yanukovych. For various different self-interested reasons. A lot of them just thought, like, even his former allies thought that he wasn't a winning bet anymore. So they all defect to the Maidan. And then, of course, what happens is you get this now sort of unholy coalition between the liberal bourgeoisie and the ultra-nationalist far right. And that's like the basis for the new political power post-2014.
Yeah. And I think it's important to underline like how disaffected Ukrainian citizens are from politics and how a lot of this is just elite politics. And yeah. When I say elite politics, I do include left political formations that yeah. kind of feed off of the liberal left faction of the oligarchs in Ukraine. So like 80-90% of Ukrainian citizens have declared for a long time that they don't participate in any civic or political organization at all. The electoral machine is just completely dominated by oligarchs, and the elites just kind of go from oligarch to oligarch depending on various material factors and like how their prospects are working out, and also like due to an informal network of family and friend ties and things like that that keep the corruption network running. I think it's very much an expression of bourgeois politics that is a bit like delayed because it hasn't been able to fully centralize administration of the country. They haven't been able to find this hegemonic power to centralize running of the country like Putin was able to. And so that's why you have so much like political turmoil. I don't think that it's because the majority of the population is involved or active in these revolutions. I think that perhaps like at some points some portion of a usually silent majority will maybe become involved and like add a bit of fuel to whatever's going on. But I think most of the stuff has nothing to do with the working classes of the Ukraine.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's true of the 2004 so-called Orange Revolution. It's true of the 2014 revolution. And this is something which I would say Ukraine has in common with almost everywhere else in the West as well, which yeah. is that the working class has been comprehensively pushed out of the political sphere. since the late 80s, early 90s. And with that, and in that, Ukraine is completely in line with Britain, is completely in line with certain other countries in Europe, and I'd say and definitely in line with the United States and Canada as well. That's a real effort that's been made by the bourgeoisie in the advanced and the less advanced nations. So Ukraine is completely in line with the rest of the capitalist world in that respect. And it's when we come to 2014, what's interesting is that when the demands from the Ukrainian working class do emerge, they emerge in the context of when the Maidan regime takes power, and then immediately, because you've got such a huge or a significant far-right presence, though it should be emphasized that the far-right organizations, they are sizable, but their significance doesn't lie that these are not like truly mass organizations.
They're only sizable with relation to the anemic political participation of the masses in Ukraine. So in that context, they are sizable, but not in a objective sense. Yeah. Like, you know, and I think also like the nationalisms and stuff that you see in the Ukraine as well only represent a very small faction of the masses. But I think they have this overemphasized importance because there's nothing else going on. And so these kinds of formations really do stick out, and they seem as though they represent like this significant mass movement or whatever within the subnational groups, but I actually think that they don't.
Yeah, as we've discussed before, when you get a situation where there is a degree of political chaos, if you can wield a small armed force, it doesn't matter if you don't represent anything other than like the will of an oligarch. If you've got a relatively disciplined and armed organization, you can do an awful lot with that, especially when the most of the population remains disaffected and withdrawn from the political sphere. So when you get like the far rightists in like burned a load of people to death in a trade union hall in Odessa, for instance, and after that you start to see like an unarmed resistance movement emerge in the east of Ukraine, often led by steel workers and coal miners, some of whom had initially been aligned with the oligarch who owned that particular section of industry. But the Donbass area kind of escapes the control of like the local oligarchs, almost all of whom defect to the Maidan regime. But what happens is you start to see, because the working class makes something of a movement in 2014 when the rebellion starts, you start to see as some class-based demands emerge from that. So there is a demand emerges in the initial period of resistance against the Maidan regime in Donbass, a demand for the expropriation of the oligarchs and the returning of their wealth to the people, the wealth that they had stolen. And of course, that certainly the people who ran the Maidan regime didn't want that to go on. They try to bring the East back into the fold by crushing it, and that doesn't work because the Ukrainian army refuses to fight, because it's a conscript army, and because these are just conscripted guys from working class families, they don't want to get involved in this war, which I think they would rightly see as just a battle between different scumbag elites. So what they have to do is, the reason why you see so much prominence given to like these nutbags in Ukraine running around with SS slashes on their uniform is because they are the fighting force of this Ukrainian government, because it can't rely on the state forces, because they've already proven that the conscripts don't want to fight for them. So they have to rely on these far-right neo-fascist, often semi-private militias of the oligarchs to do the fighting for them. And that would be the case now as well. And so the Donbass thing is interesting because it starts off with a sort of a demand for the restoration of things that had been there during the Soviet Union period and had been lost because of the looting of the oligarchs. And then what happens is, slowly as time goes on, that sort of socialistic working class element gets pushed out by a local sort of petty bourgeois faction that is more openly aligned with Moscow, because Moscow is run by a capitalist government. Putin and his particular clique aren't going to want to be associated with a rebellion that's demanding the oligarchs be expropriated. They're not going to want anything to do with that. So they exercise what control they can over that rebellion, and then you start to see it turn more from being sort of an expression of a desire for a return of certain elements of the Soviet period to being one which is more talking about the shared legacy of like the Orthodox Christianity, the defense of Russian cultural interests. So it starts off as one thing and then it turns into something else. And that as the Russian state exercises more and more influence over it, it becomes more of a sort of conventional bourgeois nationalist rebellion, the kind of which you would have seen already in Ukraine itself and also in places like the Balkans. So what starts out as something which could have been pro-working class and positive in the end gets turned into its opposite.
Right. Yeah. So it gets transformed into some like Russian, like... some kind of a movement which has heavy Russian ethnic nationalist overtones. And of course, then we know that it leads to the annexation of Crimea, which was a big international crisis at the time.
Yeah.
Annexation by Russia of Crimea. Why do you think that Russia thought that this move was necessary, like to annex Crimea? Like, what's your thoughts on it?
I think that there was a number of things going on. I think partly it's a result of the fact that as we were talking about earlier, the Russian ruling class, or certainly the faction of it around Putin, is becoming more assertive. They're not prepared to see Ukraine go wholly over into being a NATO member, for instance, and they're not prepared to lose that base they've got in Crimea, which... the Ukrainians have talked about giving it over to NATO. So even though like there's NATO operations already in that particular sea area around Russia-Ukrainian border, etc., and there's American planes in there all the time, giving NATO another foothold there is something that they didn't want to happen. Also, there's a consideration over the ability to project power in the area as well. So they would lose that if they lost access to that particular naval base. And also, I think Putin was under a degree of domestic pressure not to accept another American encroachment. I think that's a big thing, because like, you know, the idiot Gorbachev believed George H.W. Bush when he tells him back in 88, oh, don't worry, NATO won't go any further than its current existing borders. And then, of course, it does, all the way up to the Russian border. So I think there is a degree of domestic pressure from his own bourgeois faction on Putin to resist any further encroachment from NATO, because a certain section of the Russian bourgeoisie sees it as a direct threat to their interests.
There was something like 14,000 deaths in the ensuing violence. And then finally that leads to the Minsk two accords, is that correct?
Minsk.
So Minsk, thanks. Which it was supposed to be a ceasefire, but both sides have pretty much ignored it. There's been little skirmishes back and forth over the last few years.
Yeah. There's never, it's been constantly a state of like low intensity warfare around the Donbass area. And also, it should be emphasized that both Poroshenko, who was the first post-Maidan president, he did try to get more of a lasting peace, but he was immediately undercut by the sort of far-right sections of the Ukrainian bourgeoisie that were aligned with him. So they basically told him, well, no, that's a non-starter, Petro, so forget it. And the same is true of Zelensky, the current president, came in, won the last election, presidential election, by a decent majority, came in saying he wanted to end the situation of division and reunite the country and secure a peaceful settlement. But again, after not too long in power, just completely turns around and then adopts almost the same policies as Poroshenko was adopting. Again, because the balance of forces within the Ukrainian bourgeoisie is towards both belligerence towards the East, and also the fact that they as a class have become ever more dependent upon the Americans as well.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So then, this might be a good time to maybe talk about talk more of the big picture here and like what the major imperialist powers are seeking to get out of this recent escalation of violence. Hmm. So basically the recent escalation represents a kind of a formal, or it looks to be a formal breaking of the ceasefire agreement, which like still is formally in place, but maybe in practice hasn't been quite followed, but still like it's kept violence to a lower level. There's been a lot of kind of angry rhetoric coming from both sides, but also like it seems that Russia doesn't really want to do like a huge big war. As we've talked about on this podcast, and you've been saying, like Russia is looking to expand and become more of an imperialist player on the world scene, since around the early 2000s. The Americans definitely do see Russia as an emerging threat, but I don't think that Russia wants to take on the EU and NATO. I think that it, not directly at the European borders. I think it would prefer to have its fights through proxies in the Middle East, for instance, and make allyships with China to try to take on some smaller fish in other parts of the world. So I don't think that Russia wants this escalation to go further. I think it just wants to keep NATO at bay. And I think it's happy just maintaining a good level of influence within the Ukraine. So what did Zelensky do recently to make Russia think that perhaps they need to amp up the to flex some muscle? Because while Russia has said that they don't want to have a huge escalation of violence in the Donbass, they have sent military to the border and they've called in their reserves and things like that. That's what's caused a lot of the panic coming out of Zero Hedge, for instance, and other segments of the bourgeois media. But what provoked Russia or Putin to react that way?
I think that the decree signed by Zelensky under pressure from the Biden White House declared that they wanted to reconquer the renegade regions and also take back Crimea, and of course that means a direct assault on Russia. They do a direct assault on the Russian armed forces in Crimea. So it's an insane thing to proclaim because the Ukraine, as was demonstrated in 2014, has no capacity to fight the Russian army. They can't defeat the rogue region in Donbass. So how on earth are they going to take on like the Russian army, which has been significantly modernized and updated by it during the period of office of Putin, to the point where it's much smaller than it was back in the old days of the Soviet Union, of course, but it's become much more efficient. It's very much a battle-tested army because a lot of its units have been fighting in Syria for years. There's no way that the Ukrainian sort of ad hoc bunch of neo-fascist lunatics that they've got could possibly stand up to it. And that and the Americans have sold them some astonishing amount of like military hardware, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any good. So there's over $1.5 billion of arms sales that the US has pushed through. And if you remember, the whole thing around the first Trump impeachment was over his threat to delay arms sales to the Ukraine, unless Ukraine gave him evidence supposedly of like Biden's corruption, even though the evidence is actually from Biden himself speaking on camera about it. This was an interesting sort of element to the Trump impeachment, which has been largely forgotten now, that you got like a US State Department and Pentagon officials in the impeachment hearings saying that Trump went against the established foreign policy of the United States, even though that's the one area where the president is meant to have basically carte blanche to almost, if not do what he wants, then exercise a degree of autonomy from even Congress that he doesn't have in other areas. But you get these officials saying, no, the official foreign policy of the United States is that we arm and back the regime in Kiev. And Trump getting in the way of that is an impeachable offense, which is a remarkable way of essentially declaring that the president basically has no power. So it's kind of like the US imperial machine showing its hand almost.
But I don't get why the U.S. would want to I think that what's been reached in the Ukraine between Russia and the EU is a stalemate, which I actually think is mutually beneficial to both. Like, the EU is still able to benefit from cheap labor coming out of the Ukraine, and Russia is able to pursue its imperialist projects in other parts of the world where it's got more advantage, and but also keep NATO at bay in a stalemate. So I don't know why the US would want to, why would they want to disturb this balance?
I think there's a couple of things going on. Firstly, there is a split between the Europeans and the Americans on the approach to both Russia and Ukraine, slightly. Especially with the German ruling class having a lot of investments in Russia and have had for over, 30 years now, since the end of the Soviet Union. And also the Germans having a lot of interests through their foreign direct investment in Ukraine. You're right about the EU would probably prefer the stalemate to continue and then basically stabilize, because they're getting a lot of what they want out of Ukraine. And with the World Bank plan for the Ukrainian economy, they're getting even more of what they wanted in terms of Ukraine being forced to buy a load of agricultural products from the EU, in terms of privatizing what's left of the public health system, the usual stuff. But I think the thing that's going on in Washington is, as this comes back to what we've talked about a lot before, we've got in Washington basically a system of decaying state monopoly capitalism. And it's a decaying imperialism. The political system is, of course, visibly decaying. And you've got this obsession in Washington, which comes from a material place where, their interests and Russia's are banging into each other. And therefore, they have become a certain faction in the Washington the political class there has become determined that they want to try and lure Russia into a costly proxy war. And I think that the venue that they've chosen to do that, they've failed in Syria. The Russian, basically Putin, outsmarted them in Syria. But I think that they want to try and weaken Russia by luring it into a costly war in Ukraine. By essentially, and this is purely my interpretation, I think there is a faction in the US bourgeois state which would want to essentially they know that Ukraine can't beat Russia. They know that the Ukrainian army can't possibly take back Crimea. And the Americans aren't really prepared to commit to a full war with Russia. What they hope they can do is lure Russia into a war inside Ukraine proper, and then bog it down and essentially cause instability inside Russia itself by getting it stuck in a costly and extensive war. And if Ukraine gets turned into Syria in the process of that, I think that there are sections within the Washington governing circles who would be very happy with that, all for the basis of striking back at Russia and reasserting themselves, because there is a feeling inside the circles that are represented in the Biden administration that the US has been losing ground to both Russia and China. They don't really know how to confront China at the moment, so they're trying to reassert themselves by having some sort of fight with the Russians. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like it's a bit of a desperate, risky move on part of Americans that are just trying to get themselves back together after a somewhat destabilizing Trump presidency, who kind of veered a little bit off course. So maybe it's a bit of an overreaction from Biden in response to that. Yeah, I mean, do you think that, do you think anything will come of this? It doesn't sound like it.
I think what will happen is, if the Ukrainians, Zelensky clearly has just completely capitulated to Washington, because he has no real firm base of support himself. Yeah, he won the election, but this isn't a guy who the Ukrainian population is going to march into the jaws of death for.
No, he's actually a very inexperienced as a politician.
Yeah, he was a comedian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's relatively young as well.
Yeah, and I think that if they try and take back Crimea, they'll lose. I think Putin is clever enough not to stage any further intervention into Ukraine proper, because that's obviously the trap that's being laid. So I think they'll probably, if the Russians throw back any attempt at retaking Crimea, then there'll be another round of, you know, fruitless negotiations. If Zelensky is seen as losing, they'll probably, factions within the Ukrainian oligarchy will then probably try and get rid of him. Ukraine will end up subject to more political chaos, and the big losers will be the Ukrainian working class, both West and East. So essentially, this is just going to, we're going to end up back at the status quo again, but with a lot of lives ruined along the way.
Sounds like a good old capitalist solution.
Oh yeah, this is all just maneuvering. The position of the Germans is a little more interesting in that they are obviously they're in conflict slightly with the American ruling class over this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is this natural gas pipeline that the Russians are invested heavily in building, and the Germans have become more reliant on Russian natural gas for their energy, especially since they scaled back on and nearly got rid of their nuclear power sector. So the Germans, on the one hand, they adopt this subservient role to the US ruling class. But on the other hand, they've very much got their own set of interests, which are now drawing them into more contradictions with the American ruling class. So this is going to be an interesting one for the development of politics in Europe, where the interests that held the sort of transatlantic alliance together have been progressively diverging since the end of the USSR. And I think this is another case where they're going to continue to diverge further.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I do see, so Canada always immediately sides with the US.
It's a bit embarrassing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like an automatic. It's like an automatic thing. There's not even a second thought. But I do see Europe. It seems like they're not as keen on taking on a. They do seem to be kind of wavering a little bit. So we'll see. I think that they have come out in the end and against. Against Russia again, and kind of the Germans and the French have released statements condemning the recent escalation of violence, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they'll do that. And then on the other hand, they'll probably try to force some sort of compromise solution on this, I think. So very much European politics is about trying to placate the US and also then enhance their own interests.
Yeah, because I don't see the EU as having a lot to gain from this kind of aggression.
As you've outlined.
And yeah, I mean, I think it does testify to the declining strength of the United States, where in the past, I mean, at the higher points in its empire, it was able to get, for instance, Britain to do anything it wanted it to do. But at this point, it's definitely on the decline. So it's struggling to maintain its grip.
We'll still do most of what they want, but I think that's, as we've discussed before, that's a product of the fact that British finance capital has aligned itself heavily with the US in terms of the US being a way of they've aligned themselves with the US because doing so protects their interests at the moment.
Interesting. No, I just mean that, like, the U.S. used to be much more of a, not just with Britain, but they could get European countries writ large to do whatever they wanted. I was just using Britain as putting it with the EU very wrongly.
Yes, don't give us an independence of action we don't have.
Yeah. It seems like it's diminishing. I mean, it definitely is diminishing. So this is I think that this recent conflict is a good example of that weakening.
Mm. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And we'll see where it goes. I mean, I think my concluding thought on this would be that, as you said, this is all just an expression of different weaker and stronger bourgeoisies maneuvering to slice up Ukraine between them, basically. And as there's nothing in any of these sides for Ukrainian workers or any other sections of the working class at all. And none of these bourgeois factions in Ukraine have a solution. None of the oligarchy does. They haven't for 30 years. They're certainly not going to now. The only solution that the more Western orientated oligarchs have is to become ever more just the complete puppet of the United States. Some more will wish more to be more the puppet of Berlin. But for the Ukrainian working class, I'm going to repeat myself from the same thing I think I say in almost every episode, which is that until the working class acts as a class independently, not just in Ukraine, but everywhere, we're just going to see the same thing, the same bourgeois shit being repeated over and over again. And as long as the working class either doesn't act or only is able to tail end a bourgeois faction or another, then none of these problems are going to be solved. We're going to be sort of stuck on this infernal merry-go-round.
Yeah, exactly right. I think that, a possibility for Ukraine is that a Bonaparte-type character like Putin emerges and is able to reconcile the contradictions like Putin did and run the state a little bit more, a little better. But, I mean, that is more of a bourgeois thing. Like, that would be most beneficial for the bourgeoisie there because they're not able, due to the competitive nature of capitalism, to reconcile independently. They need a strong state to do that. And Ukraine, so far, has failed to create one for them. That's no solution for the working class, although I do think that would probably make for an easier political terrain for the working class if there wasn't so much political turmoil in the Ukraine and these constant creations and recreations of and destruction and recreation of political allyships between these different factions and constant quote unquote revolutions, paramilitary forces running around. I think if that wasn't there, I think things would be better for the working class perhaps, but you don't have to wait until you get there. You can just take the state for yourself.
Yes. As is, again, a recurring theme in this podcast, as you might have gathered from listening to us describe the various different factions fighting it out in Ukraine, none of these people are exactly geniuses, and yet they're the ones who hold the power. I'll repeat what I said in the episode we did on Lenin's imperialism. There's no reason why working-class Ukrainians can't do as good as or probably a way better job than the Ukrainian bourgeoisie, because they've had now 30 years of having it their own way since the end of the Soviet Union, and all they've managed to do is loot the country and turn it into a war zone. Are we really saying that the Ukrainian working class could not do better? Of course they could.
Definitely. It's the million or trillion dollar question, though.
In the age of QE, it's got to be trillion.
Yeah, exactly. How does the working class organize itself and take power? But more on that next episode for sure.
Be sure to stay tuned.
Yeah, we're gonna crack this nut.
Okay. I think we've covered it all. So should we leave it there for now?
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
Случилось, видно, это судьба. Невозможно стало жить без тебя.
Ливанские патриоты провели вчера самую крупную операцию.
Видно, счастье к нам приходит лишь раз. Поняла я это только сейчас. Мне не нужно ни афиш, ни цветов.